Blog Talk Radio.
PM Eastern Standard Time. That means it's time for another episode of Stunt Treks. I'm your most excellent host, Uncle Jim, and with me as usual is the Leslie Hoffman. How you doing tonight, Leslie?
I'm waiting for the operator to catch up to I'm doing fine. I don't know if you have it down there, but we have a tornado watch warning.
Wow.
Do you have anything like that?
No, but we're having some pretty heavy wind here in Vermont.
Oop. Wait a minute. Yeah. So,
wow.
I don't know. I'm looking out the window right now and I don't see anything, but you know, I don't see the trees blowing or anything like that. They're saying until 10 o'clock, so hopefully in three more hours that will have gone by. I don't know if any other part of New York State or Vermont is under a watch or not.
I think over in Massachusetts in Berkshire County is also a tornado watch.
Yeah, I was going to say, we also have with us the Admiral. Admiral Ken is with us. He's down in Albany. How you doing tonight, Ken?
Well, not too bad, you know. I'm trying to keep myself out of trouble.
Are you guys having a high wind advisory or tornado warnings in Albany?
Not here. Like I said, over east of us in Massachusetts. It's funny how tornadoes work. They touch down anywhere. So it's where Leslie is, and it's east of us, but it's not in between.
Strange. Well, I wanted to let you guys in on a little something. The theme song that we use for Stunt Treks, which is actually, everybody calls it the Vulcan fight theme because that was from the TOS episode of Mock Time when Spock fights Captain Kirk for Faltor Pon on Vulcan. Well, that particular song was written by a guy by the name of Gerald Free. He's 92 years old. He's the last surviving TOS composer. And I had the distinct pleasure of talking with him on Thursday night's Trek Talking. He wrote the songs and the music for this new movie called Unbelievable, the sci-fi spoof. And we also had Garrick Wong, who played Harry Kim on Voyager, and Chase Masterson, who is now Mrs. Grand Nagus Rom on Deep Space Nine. And we had a blast. It was a lot of fun. It was a great show. So if you guys haven't had a chance to listen to that show yet, please check it out. It was a lot of fun, and it was a hoot. Chase Masterson is the nicest person you'd ever want to talk to. And Garrett Wong happens to know Leslie. So we were talking, and we brought up the Vulcan fight song, which we just played for you guys at the top of the show. And Charles asked him about working with Leslie on Voyager. Because as you guys that listen to the show already know, Leslie was Valana Torres' stunt double. Leslie's done a lot of great stuff, but that's one of the things that Leslie's done. And so Garrett remembered working with Leslie and said that Leslie was a very nice person. And we're hopefully, maybe we can get him to come on this show. I'm going to see if we can make that happen. Maybe we can get him to come on and talk about, you just hang out and chat with us, you know? So anyways, I just wanted to throw that out to you guys. I thought it was pretty cool that he remembered Leslie and said that she was a nice person to work with. He also went on to say that he can't recall ever meeting a stunt person or a stunt double that wasn't a very nice person. So I think that's a compliment,
that's a lot,
Leslie.
It's a lot better than who?
No, we didn't get a who out of them. So if you guys want to check that out, do that. You can find the link to that show on our Facebook page, Trek Talking and Beyond, or you can head over to Blog Talk Radio /Trek Talking and just find the show with Chase Masterson and Garrett Wong and give it a listen, and you can hear the pleasant things that he had to say about it. And you can hear what Gerald Freed had to say about writing the Vulcan Attack song, which actually had a different title. I can't remember what the actual name of it was. It wasn't the Vulcan fight theme, but that's what it has become over the years. So we had a lot of fun. It was a great show. And I had to throw that out there for you, Leslie, that he remembered you and said you were a very nice person to work with.
Well.
See that?
Yes.
You remember well.
I mean, I'll say that probably the closest episode that we sort of worked together, we didn't do any fights together, but the closest episode that we worked together was Blood Fever, you know, when they finally let, I forget the Vork or the Vulcan and Torres. You know, they both had Ponfar and you know, they finally just let the two fight it out and get it out of their system. And Garrett was one of the people on the planet. So
he was a really nice guy.
Yeah. Oh, he really is. Yes.
He had some funny stories about Dr. Picardo, or Robert Picardo, I'm sorry, and the podcast that he does with Bobby. Who's Bobby? Paris, Tom Paris, Bobby, Rob Duncan McDeal.
You know, you had, I think there were four of them. Technically there were four Roberts, so it was like, Rob, Bob, Robbie, Bobby, you know, each one went by a different nickname that, you know, you just didn't say Robert and have four people turn around and go, who are you talking to me?
Yeah, he, Garrett and Bobby McNeil, which I'm used to hearing Robert Duncan McNeil, but he calls him Bobby. Him and Bobby decided to do a podcast called Delta Flyer, and the two of them review every single episode of Voyager. And he didn't realize all the work that was involved in doing a podcast, and it's taken them so long to do it. And I said, well, Garrett, you know what's great about our podcast? It's live, just like we are right now. If I make a mistake and say something wrong, there's no editing. You know, it's all live. So whether you're listening to us right now on Sunday night or we're listening to us next Tuesday or a month from now on Wednesday, you're going to hear the exact same show. There's no editing. So We need to make sure that we get things right because we can't fix it. So that was pretty cool. And we did have a bunch of callers too, which was really great. Which, by the way, our phone lines are open. I say it at the top of every show. Our phone number here is 646-668-2433. If you'd like to call and say hello to Leslie or myself or the Admiral, please give us a call, 646-668-2433. We'll get you on the air right now live for about another 50 minutes or so. We'll be here. So give us a call. So we have a really interesting show planned for you. I was sitting up at camp. I just moved to a new campground up in Saratoga, which is beautiful. And I got a text from Leslie. I'm like, what do we want to talk about tonight? And so we decided we would do something that we haven't really done, believe it or not. And it's not Planet of the Apes, so don't go there. No Planet of the Apes. But we're going to talk a little bit about how Leslie ended up doing stunt work, what led her in that direction, the path that she took to get there. And if anyone's listening who is thinking about, you know, a life in Hollywood or maybe following in Leslie's footsteps and going into stunt work, maybe Leslie can point you in the right direction and maybe you can learn from Leslie's story and get some pointers and help yourself on your journey. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight. Our number here again is 646-668-2433. So anyways, let's just jump right in, Leslie. So did you always know you wanted to be an actress, or when did you decide that Hollywood was calling you?
Well, I want to do a quick, today would have been Wes Craven's birthday. He would have been 81 today if he was with us. And that's, yeah. You know, there's some things, you know, Naked Gun, but Nightmare on Elm Street, Star Trek. I mean, these are the recognizable shows that I've been in, and wish him well up above or wherever he may be. But anyways,
yeah, Wes Craven has done a lot of great stuff. Scream, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street, and you know what, Leslie, I like to slip this in as often as I possibly can, and it's been a little while since I played this clip, but speaking of Nightmare on Elm Street, I think the one movie that Wes Craven will always forever be identified with is Nightmare on Elm Street and Freddy Krueger. Would you agree? Do you think that's his biggest thing?
Yeah,
he's done a lot, but I think Freddy Krueger and Nightmare on Elm Street is the one thing that he'll always be known for, like Gene Roddenberry in Star Trek. And you guys don't realize how lucky you are, but the one and only Leslie Hoffman was actually in the original Nightmare on Elm Street. She's one of the only people that ever actually played Freddy other than Robert in an original Nightmare on Elm Street. They've done reboots and things, but I mean the original run of Nightmare on Elm Street, Leslie is the only person to actually play Freddy that wasn't Robert Englund. And just to spice things up a little bit, here is the clip of Leslie's famous line from the original Nightmare on Elm Street classic. You know, if you guys could see my face right now, every time I play that, it just makes me smile. I get a little smile because I know that's Leslie right there. And so, yeah, in honor of Wes Craven, I wanted to play that for you guys and for Leslie as well. So there you have it. So.
Yeah, that's... It's amazing like I say, you can work on a really high budget movie that just has disappeared into the ether. You know, maybe some people remember the name, maybe they don't. And you can work on the most low budget film ever made, or not that, well, Nightmare on Elm Street was an extremely low budget film, the original. You know, you go, you work the day, it's a low budget, it's a horror film. Well, again, you got to remember it was the first of the original, well, of Nightmare on Elm Street. So you don't know what's going to happen with that movie. And like I say, here we are. That was filmed in 1984, and here we are in 2020. And I mean, it's an iconic horror film, just like Friday the 13th and Halloween. I mean, people just know that movie.
Now, Leslie, when you worked on, I'm just getting off track just a little bit here, but I think it's relevant to what we're talking about. Well, right now, when you were working on Nightmare on Elm Street,
well, I just wanted to say happy birthday, but somehow we took a left turn.
Well, that's okay. We can do that. It's our show. But when you were working on Nightmare on Elm Street with Wes Craven, obviously this came out after Halloween and after Friday the 13th. Did you ever get the impression that Wes Craven, that these guys were in a contest with each other, and that they were in a competition to see who could make it? Do you think there was any jealousy or animosity between any of them, or were they just trying to make a movie, in your opinion?
We were just, it was his idea, it was his script, and we were making a movie. I mean, again, when Halloween came out, when Friday the 13th came out, it's part of what I was going to talk about tonight, is that there are movies that come out that basically are the same movie, but they have different titles. It's like 2 Minute Warning and Black Sunday and I can't think of it. The one that Tom worked on, Deep Impact, I think. If it wasn't Deep Impact, it's the other one that they're basically the same movie. Two different studios, basically the same movie. But that's not, you know, Friday the 13th, Halloween, Nightmare on Elm Street, it wasn't the same movie. I mean, it had very specific, memorable characters that were their own individuals. I don't think you could really say that Jason or Michael or Freddy are cookie cutters of each other. I mean, they had their own specific characters or what they were.
Yeah, you know, Leslie, before we say, if I could choose, you know, if you guys are listening, listen to this question and give us a call and you can answer it for us, and I'll give you my answer and I'll ask Ken. If you had to die in a horror movie and you had to get killed by Freddy, Jason, or Michael, who would you want to get killed by? And for me, it's a hands-down easy question. I want to get killed by Freddy, because at least I'd die laughing, because Freddy just kills people in the most creative ways. He turns them into video games. He turns them into cockroaches. He turns into a land shark and comes up on the beach and eats them. I mean, there's nothing, you know, if Freddy's going to kill you, it's going to be in a creative way. So I would choose Freddy. How about you, Ken?
I don't know. I think more Jason. I can't, although I can't really necessarily explain it. It's just, I mean, again, back to what we were saying before. If I'm going to die, I'd rather be serious about it.
Okay. And Leslie, what about you? What Hollywood slasher guy would you rather have take you out?
Oops, I'm a... What's... none of them. I prefer to be alive.
Well, true. So if you guys
I really don't know. I don't have an answer.
All right, that's fair. But if any of you have an answer, call us 6-668-2433 and tell us if you were going to be killed by a Hollywood slasher icon, who would it be, Freddy, Jason, or Michael? Give us a call at 646-668-2433 and let us know. So, obviously, Leslie, you just didn't trek off to Hollywood, bump into Wes Craven on the street. He said, hey, I want to put you in Nightmare on Elm Street. You're going to wear Freddy's glove and Freddy's sweater. And it didn't happen quite that easy. So, when did you hear the calling of Hollywood?
Well, the town that I'm from, Saranac Lake, we're famous for what they call the cure. It was the cure for tuberculosis. And people from all walks of life came up here to breathe the cold, fresh air. But we actually had a major influx of entertainment people. As a child, I used to grow up in the William Morris, I would play at the William Morris Play Park. And that's the guy that had the William Morris Agency. His wife started a milk and cookies at the play park. It's just, well, where I'm living now originally was called the National Vaudeville Artist Lodge. It was built by the president who ran that group. And then when Will Rogers died in 1936, and plus vaudeville was going under, a group of people started a foundation or a fund for Will Rogers, and they bought the building and renamed it the Will Rogers Memorial Hospital, which people know it for that today. I mean, it has a different name. Now it's the Saranac Village at Will Rogers because it isn't a hospital anymore. But going back to, as far as I know, the earliest age that I can remember anything, I thought I wanted to be an actress. I mean, I never changed it. You know, it's like each year in school, you're asked to write, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, you know, one year you want to be a fireman, and one year you want to be a doctor, and one year, you know. And every single year as a young child, I wanted to be an actress. I mean, I now can kind of go back and say, no, I wanted to be in the entertainment industry because I got to admit is that when I was very young, I didn't know that there were stunt people. You know, you watched a movie and if there was a fight or someone's falling off a horse or something like that, you just assume that it's that character, that actor. I mean, again, as a very young child, I don't know if you even go, oh, well, that was John Wayne being this character. I mean, you went to a movie, and these here are these characters. I remember going to the movies They had a special thing for children on Saturday, and they would show the serial, you know, the part one, part two, part three of Flash Gordon, which is Buster Crabbe. And my father knew Buster Crabbe because he had a boys' camp up here. But you know, like I say, is that I didn't go to the movies and go, oh, that's Buster Crabbe being Flash Gordon. I mean, that was Flash Gordon on the screen. Anyways, so like I say, I always thought I wanted to be an actress. And I would be in school plays, and the town hall had a summer, or the town had a summer theater, and also we have a local college here, and I did a play there. But between the 11th and 12th grade year, I did two things. I went to the American Academy of Dramatic Arts to take acting lessons. And if anything, as famous as they are, they almost stopped me from becoming an actress. It was so boring. I mean, whoever they had as a teacher, it basically was, you know, walk over here, you know, just like in making televisions, you have marks on the floor that you have to hit. So, well, for television or movies, you have to hit these marks so you're in focus with the camera. You still have marks on the stage, even in a play, because the director wants you to walk over here and say your line, and then walk over there and say your line. And it was so boring. I mean, like I say, it was so disappointing. But luckily, my older brother was at Caltech in California, that actually Pasadena, and the whole family went out to visit him, and we went to the Universal Stunt Show. And, you know, I'm sitting there at this stunt show, and again, not knowing any better, or about the business, and, you know, out comes this guy, and he's talking to the audience, and then they get into their routine, and they're fighting, and they're throwing punches, and they're falling down, and they're doing high falls off the building, and it's like the light bulb went on, and I said, that's what I want to be. You know, it isn't that I wanted to just say my lines. I really wanted to be physical. I was a tomboy as a kid. I climbed trees. The backyard of the house that we lived in was the backside of the mountain that was where you went skiing. Now, the backside, like you say, was all trees and rocks and things like that. And, you know, I used to life has changed so much. I mean, you know, it isn't like parents have to know where you are every moment. I mean, you just climbed up the side of the mountain, and that was it. You know, if it got dark, you come back to the house, or like I say, you're up a tree or something like that, and it's dark. Maybe your mother is calling you for dinner or something like that. Anyways, well, so that was between 11th and 12th grade. I graduated high school. I went to another famous acting studio called Herbert Berghoff, which I got to admit that at least at this place, they did, I'll call it, acting exercises that you understood, or you started to get the concept of, you know, whatever the script is saying, you understand the character more than you've memorized a line. And actually, in stunt fighting, You know, it really is the same thing. I mean, you could do a stairfall on one show, and it's a comedy, and you could do a stairfall on another show, and it's a drama. And I mean, not well. I've said this before: is that actually comedy is harder than drama because you gotta have a straight face about comedy. If you approach comedy, you know, silly. Maybe that's not the best word to call it, but you know, if you like Leslie Nielsen's great lines from Airplane, from Naked Gun, was because he said it seriously. It wasn't that he, you know, he made a face and said it jokingly. So I got to admit, with the Herbert Berghoff Studios, I feel that, you know, that helped me understand the art of acting, which helped me with stunt work. So after the visit with my brother, I flew out to California, discovered a small gym in Santa Monica where there were other would-be stunt people, and two of them was Dennis Matalone and Tom Morga, which you see that, well, Dennis Matalone was the stunt coordinator of Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager. He wasn't the stunt coordinator on Enterprise, but other than a Ferengi, Tom Morga, I think, has played almost every alien that there is. I mean, just amazing. But who knew back in the late 70s that Dennis is from New Jersey. Tom was born and raised in Burbank, California. But who knew that the three of us would be a part of Star Trek? I mean, back, like you say, back in the late 70s.
Now, was it hard for you as a woman to break into Hollywood? Was there a stigma, or was it relatively easy for you to break through that wall?
No, it's very hard, and it's still not the easiest thing to do. I mean, you know, Tom and Dennis definitely worked a lot more than I did. One of the first shows that Dennis worked regularly was Baba Black Sheep. You know, I mean, if a show has all these male flyers, they're not going to hire a stunt woman. And the other thing, well, Dennis has always remained as an independent stuntman. Tom finally joined a group called Stuntmen's Association, Stuntmen's Association is a men's only group, so that's another thing you're fighting. So no, it was very hard. It was a lot harder for me to get work than it was for. I mean, you got to be talented too. I just don't want to make it sound like they got jobs because they were men. I mean, they're very, very talented. And that definitely did help them get jobs. But it is a male world out there.
Well, at least you had some support and some help breaking into that, though. That helped.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, well, let's go back to Nightmare on Elm Street. Is the stunt coordinator of Nightmare on Elm Street, and I don't know how many Wes Cravens, he didn't do them all, but he did a lot of them, was Tony Caesar, and actually he did the fire burn for Freddy in the original movie, but I think he's probably more recognizable as the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man in Ghostbusters. You know, when he's climbing the side of the building and he's on fire. That was Tony.
Oh, that's him? Cool. That's pretty cool. Ken, did you want to ask Leslie anything? Did you have any question that you wanted to ask her? Because I'm taking up all the time here. No, I guess we lost Ken. He'll be back shortly. Yep, we lost him.
Oh, did
we lost
had somebody
him.
With it? Oh, okay. So you know, we used to practice at this little stunt gym in Santa Monica, and would hope that we would get hired. You had to go to a set and say, you know, you had pictures of you doing high falls or whatever, and you would go to a set and you know, introduce yourself, and hopefully they would hire you. But now comes a vicious circle for men and women. In order to join the Screen Actors Guild, you had to have a union job. In order to get a union job, you had to belong to the Screen Actors Guild. So, you know, it's like, how do you break that circle? I mean, you gotta have either a stunt coordinator, or back then it was a production manager that used to hire stunt people. You had to have somebody that was willing to go to the producer and say, you know, I want to use this person. Could you write this letter? My break came on a movie called 2 Minute Warning, and it's kind of a silly story. I mean, it's so long ago now. That was the football game, like Black Sunday, and they needed people running down the hallway, and there were so many. You know, there were so many, when everyone's panicking, you can't have the same stunt people running down the hallway. I mean, so every 3 days, the stunt coordinator was hiring different people to run down the hallway. I mean, they had about 700 to 900, what you call waivers, also running down the hallway. But if they needed someone to do a fall or fall downstairs or something like that, you know, you needed a stuntman. And I got on the set, introduced myself to the stunt coordinator, and he said, if you can get, you know, the producer to write a letter, I'll use you. And I was so naive back then about this whole business, was I called up the producer's office, got hold of a secretary, explained that the stunt coordinator was going to hire me, but I needed a letter. I mean, if you were to do that nowadays, I don't know if you'd even be allowed to talk to the secretary. Anyways, the secretary says, oh, okay, what's your name? Birth date, you know, your social, whatever. And I gave it to her, and I said, you know, how soon could I have that letter? And I forget if she said, you know, today, or you could pick it up tomorrow. And I just did it. I mean, that's how I got into the business. Years later, I'm walking down the street, and I see this other stunt woman, and she says to me, you got into the business on my coattails. And I'm going, you know, I don't even know what she's talking about. It turns out that she knows a production. No, he was a producer. Let me take that back. No, he's a television producer. She was friends with a television producer who had called up. I don't even remember who was producing 2 Minute Warning, but a deal had been struck, or I don't know if I'll call it a favor as opposed to a deal, that this girl is going to call, and can you get her into the union? So when I call and the secretary hears a girl's voice saying, I need this letter, they just wrote me the letter, but it was the wrong girl. I mean,
wow, you're lucky they didn't rescind the letter.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know. I mean, I guess it's a good thing that they didn't say the name, or they forgot who the name was, or, you know, or they just were expecting a call from a girl, and they were going to write the letter and get her into the union. And I mean, she got into the union, too. She must have called maybe in that, and that's how she knows about it, is she must have called and they said, but we already wrote a letter for you to get into the union, and that's probably when they said, you know, isn't this Leslie Hoffman? However she was told. Somehow she knew I was the one that they wrote the letter for and got into the union. I mean, they still wrote a letter for her and she got into the union, but as far as I know, I don't think she's ever forgiven me I can't even say stealing her favor, because I was so naive. I didn't know that something had been planned.
Well, that's the way it is with any of the guilds. You know, take for example, like I think it's Writers Guild of America. You can't write for film or television unless you're part of the Writers Guild. But
right. You
can't get into the Writers Guild unless you've written for movies and television. So you have to literally have to have a, in the case of, I think it's Writers Guild of America, you have to have a person who's a member of the guild, in effect, float you in.
Oh, yeah. No, that's the way for...
So then you could join on your own.
Yeah. I mean, the Directors Guild is that way. I know I believe the initials, if you look at credits, is ACS or ASC, which is the photographers, the cinematic...
Cinematography Society, yeah, or... Well, actually, it's ASC. I think it's American Society of Cinematographers or something like that. But, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember now, and I'm very honored to say that I was friends with her. There was a woman named Breanne Murphy that wanted to be a cinema photographer, and she went to the head of not the elected person, but, you know, the head of the union, and this guy said to her, I would have to be dead before I would let you join. Well, guess what? Like a year and a half later, he dies.
Yeah.
She goes back to the union, speaks to the new person, and actually tells him the story, and the guy says, well, I'm not going to stop you. You know, this guy said, if I die...
You got to let her in, really.
That's the only way you're going to get in the union.
It's weird the way it works. But, you know, I mean, but in a way I understand. Because just like you are for stunt people or whatever the union you belong to, or writers or directors... or anything else, you are representing them whenever you work. If they just let anybody in and, they're, you know, they're saying, well, this person's part of the Writers Guild. If they made a mistake, it reflects back upon the guild. I mean, they're protecting themselves.
Yeah, right. which doesn't mean that there aren't non-union movies with non-union directors, non-union actors. I mean, it isn't like they have, I mean, they have a pretty good grip on Hollywood or around the different unions around the world. But in reality, hey, if you have multi-million dollars, or nowadays effects are so cheap to do, or cameras are so great, you could make a non-union movie. I mean, so times are changing. I mean, you know, independent filmmakers had a really hard time when I was doing stunt work. But nowadays, I mean, anybody could do a non-union film. I mean, well, where Paramount has the rules about the Star Trek things, but the fan films, the Star Trek fan films, are as good or better than, let's say, the original Star Trek. I mean, the special effects and things that you can do now as with the apps that you have on your computer, I mean, are amazing.
I was surprised when I saw a video on YouTube and I posted it to Trek Talking. I was surprised, but in the case of Discovery set, that's all wood. That's all lumber and millwork, that set. There's no metal there. It's all milled lumber. It's all bent lumber. When they do curves and stuff, it's not, when the consoles aren't metal, they're wood. And the skill of these people to create these things that make it appear like it's a real ship and it's made, but it's all just shaped lumber.
Oh yeah, well, actually, even on the Star Treks that I worked on, you know, the Promenade, obviously, a wooden Deep Space Nine could not exist in outer space. Yet, you know, the whole set was wood. There was no metal to speak of. It was just, you know, how it was painted, how they loved using smoke, which was technically horrible. It was, I mean, for the actors and the stunt people, we'd be in front of the camera breathing in this smoke or fog or whatever, and you look at the people behind the camera, and they're all wearing gas masks or, you know, some kind of mask. And you go, wait a minute, why are they wearing masks and I'm sitting here breathing this oil-based, you know, fog or whatever? But,
I mean,
but
you
like,
know, go,
hey, well,
the other, not to get off on the tangent, but in the TV show I Dream of Genie, to show you the effect that they used with the smoke genie, was just chunks of dry ice dumped in a bucket.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's simple.
You think about
even the original Star Trek, I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched, Batman. Batman, I swear they loved using color smoke, you know, to knock them out or whatever they were, or to just disappear out of the room. They'd throw something on the floor, and you got to remember, color television was coming into being, so you'd have purple smoke and green smoke and all, you know, just very colorful smoke, which I still enjoy. I mean, you go
again. You're getting back to
Batman,
what you said about
Batman
the original
was,
Star Trek. That's why the color. That's why the colors in the original series were the colors they were, because it was just when they were just trying to show off what they could do with color television.
I'm sure. Because
you look at those colors and it's like, I mean, no self-respecting ship afloat or in the air would paint it that way.
Right. I mean, it was, I'm sure the producers and the television companies had a big deal or had a deal about trying to sell color television sets to the public. I mean, that's why NBC had the Peacock, who would open up its tail feathers and you'd see all these colors, or the Wonderful World color, whatever, the Wonderful World of Disney was, you know, color.
Right. One of the most classic examples, Wizard of Oz. You know, the fact that all the Kansas scenes were in black and white and all the Oz scenes were in color, because they were trying to experiment with color, and whoever wrote the script in that particular circumstance said, well, gee, you know, that'd be a good place to break. You know, as soon as she lands in Oz, we'll switch to color.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, you're talking about 1939, which was the most incredible year of movies being made. I mean, there's at least 10 or more movies. I mean, I right off the top of my head, I can't start naming them to you. But actually, what happened, one of the things that happened in 1939 was Selznick bought up all the color film. So a bunch of the classics from 1939 were forced to film in black and white because Selznick had bought the color film. I mean, I don't know how MGM was able to grab enough color film to even do The Wizard of Oz. But that's the story I've always heard, that, you know, I mean, you had Technicolor or Eastman Kodak, and it was a certain type of color film, and they couldn't make it fast enough. I mean, it was something absolutely brand new.
Well, then I'm trying to think of whether in recent memory, I think it's either Technicolor or one of the other things. The only processing plant was in China. Nobody processed the stuff anymore.
Well, it's interesting. Even the silent films, there are some silent films that they actually went back and painted per frame the scenes. But it would only be like a small segment. I don't remember if it was 19... Well, I don't remember. It was in the 20s. But it was like, I don't know if it was called Your King of Kings, or it was a film about Jesus. And it was interesting is that they had two sections in the movie that, like I say, maybe they were each about 5 minutes long, and they hand painted each section. But it, I mean, which must have been amazing for people to go to a movie back in the 20s and see something in color.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I think that's. I mean, you know, of course, another kind of cute story. You know, the cameras I have, the still cameras I have. I mean, I had them for I don't know how long, but only a couple of years ago did I realize I could actually shoot in black and white. I mean, shoot originally in black and white. I didn't have to take a program and convert it. The camera would actually do it for me. And I went like, I said, you're an idiot. I mean, you know, it's like you could have been doing this all along.
Well, you were talking about motors. Is that in the 20s, cameras were not motorized. It was that they were, and this is how you had a reputation as a cinematographer, is you actually had a little handle and you would rotate it. And there were guys that were just really great at rotating the handle at a perfect rate and get the scene that they needed. I mean, thank God they didn't have to. A movie wasn't filmed all together, but you know, I mean, if the scene went on for 5 minutes, this guy had to keep spinning the camera, rotating the handle at this perfect speed, or you know, it would either make the actors slow up or speed down by the time, you know, if you process the film. So, So like you say, there were very few guys back then that just were known for being able to keep the camera going at the same speed. I mean, that'd be an interesting thing to look up to see when the first motorized camera was made.
Well, you
maybe
know
I'll
what?
Do that for fun.
I don't know. I'll check to see if I can find out. You know, maybe
we
for next week.
We can discuss that in another show, Leslie, because take a look at your clock.
Yeah, I was looking at it. Is that it? Another hour has gone away. I'll quickly wrap up and say I'm glad. I'm really sad about what's going on in Hollywood, but I'm glad that I had my time there and didn't have to deal with this pandemic, which. I mean, Hollywood is still basically at a standstill. I understand that there's a couple of shows filming, but then the next thing you read is, you know, someone has the virus and they've shut down the show, or they aren't following the rules and the show is being shut down. You know, they're doing their best to try to get things going again, but it's a long, hard road, and I'll just say I wish them the best, but I'm glad that my time was not during what's going on now.
Well, and on that note, we're going to wrap things up here. Another episode of Stunt Trek has come and gone. I want to take this opportunity to thank the Admiral Ken for hanging out and chatting with us tonight. Thank you very much, Ken.
Hello.
And also, we couldn't do Stunt Treks without the one and only Leslie Hoffman. So thank you very much for hanging out and sharing your stories with us tonight, Leslie. We really appreciate it.
Oh, it was fun. Now I don't know. I still have to take my puppy dog outside. I hope we aren't going to land where I'm trying to be funny. I hope we're not going to go up in a tornado and land on top of a witch or something.
And your little dog, too.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
No. And I just want to remind you guys that you can say hello to Leslie. Just head over to the Leslie Hoffman Appreciation Organization Facebook page and say hello to Leslie over there. I want to remind you guys that we have 23 consecutive Thursdays with brand new Star Trek, starting with Lower Decks on Thursday. And when that wraps up, we're going to go right into Discovery. So we have 23 weeks of Star Trek. This is awesome. So you guys can tune in to Trek Talking on Thursday night. And we're going to review episode 1 of Lower Decks. So tune in and check that out, please. I'm your host, Uncle Jim. I want to say thank you to all you guys listening. Thank you to everybody for making this possible. I want to tell everybody to be good to each other and be safe. And we'll be back with another show of Stunt Trek next Sunday. Same bat time, same bat channel. And with that, I'm going to say good night. Talk to y'all later.
Good night,
bye-bye.
All.
Yep, there we go. Oh, there we go.
Let's see what's out there. Engage.